We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank wants to know how you reward yourself, because they have cards that make every day more rewarding. Are you a points hoarder, cashback guru, low intro APR lover? With U.S. Bank, it's up to you, because they have the cards to fit your lifestyle. So earn more whether you're shopping at a gas station or grocery store, even while planning a staycation. Learn more at usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast for Thursday, February 25th. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined, as always, by Mario Puig. We are coming to you both visually and audibly. Is that a word? No, it is not.
Audibly. Oh,
well. So, audibly. Yeah, so we're off to a hot start here. But yes, podcast being the visual medium that they are, we're in. We're in the frontier, brother. So it's good to see your face.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, it's good. It's good to see you for breaking this isolation that I've had. But yeah, I don't know how I feel about this. I don't want people to see all this, the stupid, you know, facial expressions that I make when I'm thinking of the bad ideas that I say and things like that. It's like I think I come across better despite having a voice. How does it go? I have a face for, you know. I don't have the voice for radio, whatever the opposite of that is, but then, like, I also look stupid in the visual format, so it's just, I'd rather just kind of have you podcast visually and audio-wise, and then I just kind of, like, send a transcript that you can read. That would be better.
Or dubbed over.
Yeah.
You know, I'll see what the budget looks like to see if we can both get the Scanner Darkly suits.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. So get those all mixed up around, and we can look like mid-2000s Keanu and Robert Downey Jr., that
Absolutely.
Sort of thing. But there's a lot going on. It is the end of February. We're not quite to the league new year just yet, but that doesn't mean that we're short on drama by any means. So kind of a bombshell was dropped this morning coming from The Athletic. A couple of their writers, Michael Sean Duggar, Mike Sando, and Jason Jenks, kind of combined forces to – those are the plugged-in Seattle reporters, of course – just to talk about the rift that is growing with Russell Wilson and his camp and the Seattle Seahawks. This is something that, you know, a few weeks ago, you know, doing radio hits or whatever, you get asked about it, and it's like, you know, are you buying this? I'm like, no, I think, like, the biggest quarterback that's going to get moved this offseason is probably Deshaun Watson, but I think this Russ thing, I think he's just kind of planting his flag, kind of flexing his muscle a little bit within the organization, and just kind of stating his demands, but I don't think that he's going anywhere, and I don't think that any team could really pony up the requisite resources to go ahead and acquire Russell Wilson for what the Seahawks would really want for him. So I haven't really thought that this was going to be a thing, and clearly I was off because it looks like there's more than just you know, some smoke here. There might be some actual fire when it comes to Russ and the Seahawks.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a question of, like, is this Russell Wilson being fully permanently alienated from the team, or is this Russell Wilson sort of playing his position and testing the market testing the market for, like, what he could kind of get away with for what his position is? And I don't say get away with, like, in any negative tone, because I think it's cool that the players and quarterbacks like him are using their position to leverage their worth to the team, to make the team kind of, like, respect them in ways that they otherwise wouldn't. It's like, it's not like the Russell Wilson throw it 50 times a game thing would have fixed whatever could have gone better for the team the past few years. Their second half collapse in 2020 kind of showed that they needed a balanced offense. They needed to run the ball. Things like that were not, like, the only thing wrong with the team. And Wilson is not quite infallible as a quarterback. Like, to me, he's like quarterback 5, 6, something like that. But he's still a really good player, and the team should have done a better job of heeding his insights. And it sounds like they basically just kind of did whatever they wanted, didn't really include his thoughts in the process. And that's disrespectful, and it's bad business if you're the Seahawks, because it's like they assumed he didn't need to be listened to because he couldn't do anything about it. And now here he is seeing what he can do about it. And, you know, in hindsight, I bet they wish they had just given him more of a platform within the team.
Yeah, this is just such a strange development, because like you said, like you alluded to, the let Russ cook opening stanza to this season, where he's out there chucking it 40, 50 times a game, that season opener in Atlanta where he throws, what, 4 touchdowns, just totally lights up the Falcons. And, you know, that continues. Like, it almost felt like he was the stone cold lock to be the MVP all the way through the first 6, 7 weeks of the season. Things fell apart a little bit. The Athletic article kind of points to that game in Buffalo as a bit of a turning point, where he had a bunch of turnovers, some sacks, that sort of thing. And from there, and, you know, to my detriment in the RotoWire Stake League, I just continued to believe that they're gonna click back eventually.
Well, you could bench him.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a weird, very weird season, because you look at the season end numbers of this 2020 season for Wilson, and you think, wow, he must have been insanely good that year. Nothing could have gone wrong. Look how much better these numbers are than the prior years. And yet, like you said, pretty much all of it happened in the first 7 or 8 weeks or whatever. And I think there's a possibility for, like, a middle range between, you know, the heights of week one and the falling off in week two. And I think they can get kind of the big year-end numbers more evenly applied with a few tweaks of personnel and, you know, their approach otherwise. But yeah, it was a weird situation politically from that point, because it's like, I bet there are things Wilson could have thought of that would have helped Carroll make it work better. Things that aren't as simple as, we just got to run more. And yet, you know, there's a little bit to it. They got to run more if they want to get the specific looks that they used to get from defenses when they did run all the time. But it's not as simple as, you know, that stuff where they're like, if you run 25 times in a game, you win 80% of the time. So just run it 25 times. Like, that stuff's ridiculous too. Yeah. So I think they could negotiate, like, a reasonable outcome. And I guess, since I don't think they need much change to get where Wilson wants to be, I too would be surprised if he's moved. But I don't know, if like we've seen with Deshaun Watson, that some players just have a line. You can't cross the red line with them. And if you do, they are principled such that they will just never cooperate with you again. And I'd be surprised if Wilson is that guy. I think Deshaun has shown that he is that guy. I don't think the stakes are as serious with Wilson, both because, like, I don't think he – I think he's dropping this – he's leaking this info to the press to kind of pressure Carroll into listening to him. I don't think he's pressuring him into getting off the team, because why would he want to leave a team where he's so close to having it exactly the way he wants it, you know?
Yeah, like what the Jets are, you know, kind of the team, and we'll get to them in a minute as a team with potentially the ammo to make it work there. But like you said, like Seattle is, you know, a playoff team. They're established. You have DK Metcalf. You have Tyler Lockett. You know, that you're really not that far away from again being a legitimate contender in the NFC, whereas you'd be on a bit of a reclamation project there in New York if you ended up going to the Jets. So it does feel like you were saying, there is something to be said for Russ wanting to be listened to by Pete Carroll and the brain trust. It sounded like at certain points during the season he would come to them with you know, tweaks potentially to install into the offense, and was basically just kind of pushed aside. So like you said, maybe this is him coming back to the bargaining table with a little bit more like public pressure being put on the organization that way to eventually get what he wants. Because, you know, it is true that Seattle has one of the lowest investments in their offensive line of basically any team in the NFL, either draft capital or salary wise. So, I mean, it's not a particularly great situation, not a particularly great offensive line that he's playing behind. And then, like you said, once they get dogmatic about running it X number of times a game and that being a formula without really thinking about what needs to go into that for it to work, it's all kind of a little bit messy there. So I think Seattle does need to really listen up, because if you screw this up, especially when Russ was kind of a gift from the heavens to you to begin with, I mean, if you're drafting at a time like now, if Russell, basically, they got Russell Wilson in the third round because guys like, or NFL brain trust love really tall quarterbacks, especially in the earlier part of this decade and you know, all the way further back. That's why like guys like Brock Osweiler, Paxton Lynch, these sort of guys get pushed up really, really high up draft boards, and guys like Drew Brees, like Russell Wilson, fell further and further in draft. So the Seattle is lucky that they've even had this guy in the first place. They need to do whatever it takes to keep him happy, in my opinion.
Yeah, and again, since they did so well in those first 8 weeks, they are not as bad as those last 8 weeks might have looked. It's like if they could keep a little more perspective about it all, they basically were two good games difference from thinking everything was rosy. So, yeah, I think that Pete Carroll has kind of screwed it up to this point, and Russell Wilson is pretty much justified in reacting the way he has, especially after Pete Carroll threw Brian Schottenheimer away as the scapegoat. It's like, all right, you were telling me you can't listen to my ideas for the past few years because you got to do what you and Brian were thinking of. Then you fire Brian and say it's all his fault. It's like, how about you just listen to me from the start and we could have skipped all this? You know, Brian never needed to get fired. He could have just implemented my ideas to what you were already doing. And when that's the gap, I just think it's too short of a gap to justify a total upheaval. Whereas with the Houston case, it's like, Jack Easterby is a total psychopath and a megalomaniac freak who cannot be reformed and has only ill intentions and will do anything underhanded to any extent to get what he wants. That's a person you cannot work with. And so it makes sense for Deshaun to take his position the way he has.
Yeah, I finally heard the Easterby stand-up.
Oh, my God, dude. It's so good. It's so good.
Folks, if you want to hear a really good New York accent, check that out for sure. Rounding this out a little bit, and speaking of New York, what one potential trade package, I forget who to attribute this one to exactly, so forgive me there, but one, you know, again, I still feel like this is pie in the sky, but a package I saw would have been Quinnen Williams, both the Jets first rounders this year and a first rounder next year would get Russell Wilson. What say you?
I think that would probably do it. I mean, he's a bit older than Deshaun, and he's I don't know. It's I don't know what to make of the whole market as it is, though. You know, it's like I think that should be enough. I can imagine Seattle still saying like, oh, we want more than that, but it's hard for me to imagine them getting more than that in a market where everybody who is available is the way they are, or, you know, could be available. It's like, it's not just the Deshaun and the Russell Wilson part. It's like, we don't know how the Sam Darnold domino is going to fall. We don't know what that might knock over in response. It's like if Jimmy Garoppolo were cut and San Francisco traded for Sam Darnold, it's like that would be a big shakeup too. And so I don't know. Like, I don't know if there's any teams that are kind of waiting on this or that to fall. And I don't know if they view the rare number of alternatives in this offseason as a reason to lower their offers like they should. But I'm almost wondering if we're going to reach this point, like we almost did with Carson Wentz and the Eagles. But like we're reaching this point where we have this sort of like critical mass of quarterbacks who are alienated from their teams and are signed to these contracts with these cap penalties that basically can't be withstood by the teams that need to move them because they refuse to play for them, or they, you know, they might not want to play for them now. They're alienated from them. And it's like there's no market. There's no team that has the number of assets that they're looking to receive to justify eating those cap penalties. So what we basically run into is a scenario where things gridlock and then the teams demand a bailout or something, or like cap forgiveness or something like that, because it's like they're sitting around saying, we're not going to play our best player, the player that's marketable to the NFL, not just us, you know, thinking of Deshaun Watson especially, and they're just saying like, we can't trade him because no one offered us enough. It's like what is enough is what is available in your case, because you burned the bridge, you know. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like Jack Easterby's trying to take some tough guy stance, like, well, we're just gonna not trade him and fine him. And it's like that's something that the league has never seen before, and I'm not convinced that they let it go that way, you know. But like it's a factor. As long as Deshaun is not traded, then the Russell Wilson demands can only go so high. And to me, the three first rounders in Quinnen Williams sounds like probably the best case scenario, really.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, that would get it done. Obviously the Jets have that ammo, so it'll be interesting to see the direction in which they go with it, whether they go out and are able to acquire a guy like Russell Wilson or Deshaun Watson, or I don't know what else. I don't really see Sam Darnold being back there and then building around him, especially with the new coaching staff in place. I don't think Darnold's toast, but I would like to see him go somewhere else and kind of just get a fresh
Denver.
Start.
Denver.
Yes. Denver. Yes, yeah. That would be ideal. Let's move on over to the other quarterback news from this week. So when we talked last, it sounded like things were getting pretty icy between Ben Roethlisberger and Pittsburgh. It seemed like the Pittsburgh brass was kind of playing hardball publicly with Roethlisberger a little bit. Obviously, he's carrying a pretty expensive number this year. Nothing crazy, but still $19 million, especially for what current state Ben Roethlisberger is. That's not something that is particularly palatable, especially for a team like the Steelers that needs to cut a little bit of cap. But sounds like Roethlisberger and the Rooneys met earlier this week, and it seems like Roethlisberger will be back with the Steelers this year, albeit most likely with a reduced salary, some sort of pay cut is probably in the works there. But what's your reaction there with Pittsburgh trying one more time with Roethlisberger, especially given how we saw the last season end?
Yeah, maybe they don't really have a better option than this. Like, I assume they're smart enough to know that it's not a good situation having Ben Roethlisberger as your starting quarterback. And maybe to them, it was just the best option in a limited line of choices. So I don't know what their perspective on the whole thing is, but if they have high hopes, I would let that go if I were them, because I don't know what exactly went wrong with Roethlisberger last year, but it went completely, to me, it looked irreparably like just botched. Like, I don't know what you can do to fix a quarterback who looked that way. And in a way, it's, I don't know whether this is good or bad, or I could just be wrong about the whole thing, but he was so bad and so just conclusively useless that I almost wonder if it fully was the elbow that could be explained. Because if he had just been if he was out there and he was just kind of like having these dead ducks coming out, you know, like if he was just showing no velocity at all, I think that would have been obvious enough. Like, we would have been, oh yeah, his elbow is completely toast. But he, don't get me wrong, he didn't put good velocity or anything. That was definitely part of the problem. But the problem to me almost looked more like he couldn't move as fast as he needed to get the ball where he knew it needed to go. Or at the point of a play where he basically needed to make a decision, it was so early in the play relative to in the past, because I don't know if it's like the feet are slower, you know, the shoulder and elbow are slower.
Yeah,
the
elbow is weaker. He doesn't want to get hit anymore.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I really don't know what it is, but like he seemed just completely wrong. And maybe the elbow gets a little better with an extra year. Maybe he kind of learns how to play within himself again and kind of like devises an adjustment to this new status quo. But he was struggling to complete more than like 65% of his passes while averaging less than 6.5 yards per attempt. And in the modern NFL, post illegal contact rules, you know, not just people forget they implemented those illegal contact rules with a heightened emphasis after the 2000 Super Bowl when Otis Smith was mugging Isaac Bruce and Torrey Holt all game. That was the first time. And then a few years ago, they were like, we got to emphasize it even more now. And so with those two rule changes, numbers like Roethlisberger had last year are truly abominable. Like, you can't really do much worse than he did. Anytime you do half as bad as he did, you usually get benched, and Steelers instead are going into another year with him. So I think it bodes poorly for them, but I don't know what their like multi-year plan is. For all I know, they're like, yeah, to hell with it. Let's kind of just tank. Let's let Roethlisberger just wear out his contract and we'll regroup in a year. Like, maybe that's how they see it. If they see it that way, that's reasonable. But if they think they're going to compete with Roethlisberger, I think that's a long shot at the very least.
Yeah. Like, I know that they won the division this past year, but I don't really see, I think that they're the third best team in the division.
I think they're the third. And if there were like a real franchise other than the Bengals, they would be at risk of being the worst in the division, even with that insanely good defense.
Yeah. So I think like you were saying, it, in terms of like giving the Steelers some benefit of the doubt, this could just be a 1 year. I think we're looking at maybe 6-10, 7-9 if they run this back the same way and things look the same, because I just don't think that Roethlisberger really has it anymore. Somebody had a great tweet during the season that Roethlisberger plays like your uncle that just finished off his second Thanksgiving plate, and the kids finally beg him to like go outside and throw a few passes, like just kind of getting rid of it and then just like going back inside. And that's kind of how I view it as well. I completely agreed with that sentiment. And this Steelers offense is weird. And then I think that there's just like some fantasy fallout that goes alongside of it. I'm kind of teeing you up here, but when you're talking about just like investing in this Steelers offense, they have talented receivers. They have Chase Claypool. I know Juju Smith-Schuster is hitting free agency potentially. They have Deontay Johnson, but with current state Roethlisberger, I mean, does that kind of steer you away from these guys in drafts?
Yeah. There's value in all those guys that you named. If Juju's back, you know, he's not going to just disappear or something. He's, I think, the best of those three receivers, actually. But last year he had the most thankless task of the three, and certainly in terms of fantasy football, the most thankless task, because he was largely getting beat up the way he did because he was doing I don't know if this is like some new paradigm that's occurring, but the way that the Rams use Cooper Kupp and the way that the Chiefs have been using Sammy Watkins is kind of a lot like they were using Juju in Pittsburgh, where they're playing receiver, but they sure seem to be doing a lot of things that tight ends used to do, where they're not just in the sense of like where they're running, although that certainly applies, but it's like they're putting them in to block these like defensive ends and stuff like that, and do these edge setting blocks, which it wears on you, and it means that you're on a part of the formation most of the time where it's not as specifically designed to throw it to you as it is the guy who is not involved in any sort of run blocking design. So that's Deontay on the outside. And so you got this thing where it's like, Juju's better. I think it's safe to say that Juju Smith-Schuster is better than Deontay Johnson. I know people can't distinguish PPR points or even target volume from real life anything at all, but he's in the part of the field where Roethlisberger struggles most to throw it. It might be harder at this point for Roethlisberger to throw in the middle of the field than the downfield part of the field. See,
yeah, because downfield you can wind up a little bit, like it where Juju's running. Yeah. Like you need tight window
throws. Yeah, and you need to make a decision quickly, and you need to move the ball quickly. And even if he's making the decision correctly, which I think Roethlisberger is, it's like Roethlisberger still knows what's going on. He's just helpless to do anything about it. But basically it's like between his windup, between his heavy feet, between the drag on the elbow. I don't know, but whatever the combination of factors is, it's like he kept doing this thing where he would get the snap and he would decide, I need to get rid of the ball. He concluded at this point in a play over and over, if I don't start winding up, if I don't start getting my feet ready and winding up and throwing the ball, I'm going to get clobbered while I'm throwing it, and that's no good. And the only option that he had at that point in the play was to just throw it over to Deontay Johnson in single coverage and hope it worked. So I don't even blame Deontay Johnson for his low catch rate, his low yards per target, because so many of those throws were just helpless. You know, just they were throwaways borderline, and he had to make a lot of plays that just aren't fair to expect of him. But the point is that also means that his target volume is not signal. It's noisy. And if those throws that he's getting are categorically non-viable, then we may as well lower his effective target count. And you see the price for Deontay Johnson very much assumes growth. Like people are, his price right now assumes that Juju Smith-Schuster will walk and that basically Ben Roethlisberger will get better and that the target volume will either stay the same or get higher. All of which sound like long shots to me. So I don't have any interest in bidding for those prices.
No, there's always going to be someone else in the room that likes Deontay Johnson a little bit more. Let's jump on over. Last time we talked, it was the day before Carson Wentz was dealt to Indianapolis, of course. It sounds like we're off to a great start in Indianapolis with Michael Pittman just being like, yeah, I'm gonna keep 11. I'm 11. And Wentz like, oh, that's cool. I was totally gonna change numbers anyway. So that's a whole thing. But other than that, I mean, you know, this is something that we've talked about, but backstage and whatnot. But and we'll use this as a jumping off point because you're taking part in an FFPC best ball draft that's a super flex. Correct me if I'm wrong on the format, super flex, and then tight end premium scoring as well. So that, of course, with Carson Wentz officially being out of Philadelphia, we correctly kind of just assumed that Jalen Hurts' ADP would go nuts. So give us the latest on what's going on with that, and are we buying it?
Right. So in that league, it's FFPC. It's 1.5 points PPR for tight ends. That's the premium twist at the position. This is a league where there's, of course, a lot of inflation at quarterback and a lot of inflation at tight end. And almost as importantly, it starts two receivers instead of three. So it's two running backs, two receivers. And between the two receivers and then those the details with the quarterbacks and tight ends, you get intense deflation at wide receiver, or at least quite a bit more that you don't see in other formats, really. So the tight ends went quick, the quarterbacks went quick, and Jalen Hurts, I think, went way too early. Even with the news that Carson Wentz was traded, even with the super flex detail, Jalen Hurts went in the second round of this draft, the fourth to last pick in the second round, in between Ryan Tannehill, who went the pick earlier, and Tom Brady, who went the next pick. Joe Burrow went seven picks later.
Same team, looks like.
Yep. So I get it. I get chasing the upside of Jalen Hurts. And if someone is expressly buying him, paying the price that it takes just to get that upside, then I can't really argue with that person because the upside is there. I don't think anyone should really debate that. Like, I think that Jalen Hurts, at least for a one-year window, it's like he could have, I don't know, like a top five sort of quarterback outcome just from the rushing production that he's capable of. Not that he's a bad quarterback, not a bad passer, but it's just he's not very accurate, and there's only so much you can do about that. And it's not like he has a cannon arm either. So the safeties are free to come up at the line of scrimmage a little bit. And he was a great runner in those four games last year, but we don't really know how that's going to negotiate with the defense. Like, is he going to be as good of a runner if they pull the safeties up? Like, did they pull the safeties up last year, or were they kind of like, we got to stay back to do containment on this guy? And maybe if the safeties come up, that clogs the field and he can't read the defense anymore. We don't really know how all that stuff's going to go. So if someone's chasing the upside, again, I can't really say anything against it, but if they are misunderstanding the floor, then that could be a pick that they really regret, because if you're assuming really anything at all with Hurts, you're probably just wrong. You're probably missing something, because the Eagles could absolutely still take a quarterback at that sixth pick. They could trade up to take a quarterback for all we know. There's not a particular reason why they need to be committed to Hurts. And I say that as someone who's probably a little higher than on Hurts than most people. Like, I believe there's a way you can leverage that running ability to get a defense to kind of be shorthanded against the pass and thus kind of cover for Hurts's limitations accuracy wise. But that's a lot of ifs, and I hate Tom Brady, but I'm not taking Hurts ahead of Tom Brady in Superflex. And I'm definitely not taking Hurts ahead of Trevor Lawrence, who I took in the third round. But yeah, that's a lot for Hurts, I think. And it's one of those things, like, if the people who are paying the price understand that they're basically buying a coin flip, you know, for $1 million, and it's like, if you get the wrong side, you get nothing. Like, that person, I guess, has realistic expectations. But if people are assuming so much as Hurts is definitely the starter, they're wrong to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I can definitely see that. I think I would be like you said, you can't rule out the possibility of Philadelphia, if they fall in love with one of these quarterbacks from the sixth spot, or even being able to move up a little bit to secure their specific guy, then, you know, like you said, like this Jalen Hurts investment in the second round just, you know, is dust right away. I imagine that just by virtue of him playing on a day two contract, this is a with the new coaching staff, this is a great opportunity for Philadelphia, I think, to really kick the tires, see what they have in him. I mean, I thought he showed enough down the stretch last year to where Philadelphia, it would be smart of them, in my opinion, to at least try it for a year with them. I mean, they're going to have such low expectations for this season. Just go ahead and see if you may have stumbled into your guy in Jalen Hurts, especially after giving away Carson Wentz like this. So I assume at the very least that he will be the starter, but at the same time, like you said, there are things where teams can catch up to him and you know, maybe negate some of the advantages that he had down the stretch last year.
Yeah, I would also, to be clear, guess that he is the starter in Philadelphia. It's just one of those things that, like, the price is assuming he definitely is, you know, and it's like, that's a little bit much.
And that he's going to be amazing.
Right, yeah. So, I don't know, I wish him the best. I hope he does well, and I agree that if I was Philadelphia in their particular position with their cap hell that they're in, to me, that means it doesn't make sense to trade up for a quarterback, because, like, why do you want to put, even if it's a really good quarterback, why do you want to put him on a rookie contract where you can't spend at the positions that you need to make him have enough support to win a Super Bowl? So it's like, if they get Justin Fields, it's like, that's fine. You know, he's a really good prospect. They won't be sad that they have him, but they might find any way that they get to the last year of his contract and he holds out right when they need to get rid of whatever toxic contracts they have that day. And they have needs piling up at other positions. So I think it makes sense to go with Hurts to weather that 1 year of cap hell, if nothing else. And then it's like, if they go into next offseason and he had a good year, then all right, we got a good quarterback. That's fine. And if he turns out to be bad, then they're like, all right, well, we got a high draft pick and a bunch of cap space coming off the books, so whatever.
Exactly. So you know, Philadelphia, you're kind of in this position now where, like, coming into this offseason, they had to kind of pay the piper for a lot of previous mistakes and the, you know, all the Carson Wentz stuff, of course. But they could just be like a year away from kind of just being reset and kind of
you know,
out of that cap hell and you know, onto better days. So
I would take Farley if I was them and hope that a Jalen Hurts offense plus an improved defense can get them to the division and just work from there.
See, exactly. So the dark ages in Philadelphia might not last nearly as long as I was kind of expecting coming into this year. And then, you know, all this talk of Jalen Hurts and Justin Fields in the same sentence takes me back as a Georgia fan to the 2018 SEC championship game where Jalen Hurts went ahead and ripped the heart right out of my chest, and Georgia also used Justin Fields on a fake punt attempt. Okay, I'm spiraling. Anywho, let's get on to the rest of your team. So, starting things off, what was, with the scoring format in mind, what was your strategy picking out of the seven spot? Which direction did you want to go? Were you dogmatic in thinking, like, I am definitely taking a tight end here if there's one that I like? Or if there is a certain running back that fell to you, would you have gone that way? Were you absolutely fading receiver? Were you going to think about a quarterback? What was going through your mind at seven?
So I've never done a Superflex tight end premium draft, other than, I guess, like, the Scott Fishbowl was the closest thing to it that I'm aware of in my history. So I went into this very much the opposite of dogmatic. Like, I went in confused and nervous and anxious about pretty much everything, but especially the quarterback question and to a lesser extent the tight end question, because I knew that because there's only really, to me, three tight ends who safely stand out, I went in knowing, like, I might not get one of those guys. There's only three of them. So if I can't get them, that can't possibly be a big deal. Or everybody who doesn't get one of those three tight ends in a league like this is just doomed from day one. And that seemed kind of like a long shot, too. So I didn't worry specifically about tight end, but quarterback I did, because the first pick was Travis Kelce. So that makes enough sense. I think we can see the reasoning there. The next picks were Pat Mahomes, Josh Allen, Christian McCaffrey. And I think that person might regret taking Christian McCaffrey. Then Kyler Murray, then Dalvin Cook. I think that guy might regret taking Dalvin Cook. So I'm on the clock, and on the board we have basically, to me, I was looking at Lamar Jackson and Darren Waller. Okay. And I thought about Lamar, and then I thought further about it. I'm going to get a lot of Lamar shares this year. I can tell that already. I can tell that because people are – we're at that phase in time where the goldfish brains of people are leading them to conclude things like Josh Allen is clearly better than Lamar Jackson. And Lamar Jackson's actually a bad passer if you think about it. And it's like, if you had a more advanced brain than that of a goldfish, you would remember Lamar Jackson's younger than Josh Allen and won the MVP at 22 or whatever. And clearly if you gave Lamar Jackson the offense that Josh Allen has to work with, like that would not even be close. Like, Lamar Jackson is clearly the better player. I understand that's not the question in fantasy. Josh Allen has Stephon Diggs and Lamar Jackson doesn't. But when the price is that far apart, I know I'm going to hammer Lamar Jackson. I'm going to hammer maybe if Dak has an injury discount. I don't know. Stuff like that. But I'm not paying the 2021 price for Josh Allen when the 2021 price for Lamar Jackson is what it is. And so I knew I was going to get a lot of Lamar shares in other drafts. What I was less sure of is whether I would ever have another Superflex tight end premium draft where I'm at the seventh spot and I can take a guy like Waller. I didn't really see that particular scenario happening again. So if only to kind of like balance my exposure, ostensibly anyway, I went with Waller there. And Waller is my tight end too. I understand that most people have Kittle ranked there. The reason I disagree with them is because I think they're just underrating Waller still. And I think that George Kittle's durability history is actually concerning. And it's Absolutely. Not just the past couple of years. It was the thing at Iowa. It's largely why he fell to the fifth round of his draft.
Right.
So I took Waller there because if that's 100 catches, that's 150 PPR points. You know, that's as many points as if you have a receiver who catches 150 passes. So I know some people think I reach for Waller. I don't see it that way. I think anyone who doubts Waller at this point still doesn't know what to look for. And it's going to be their second year in a row of being confused. So I went there. Lamar, of course, did not make it to my second pick. I was hoping to get Russell Wilson there. Maybe that was naive, but Russell Wilson went a few picks earlier. Aaron Rodgers went a couple picks earlier, but I was okay with that because I have Matt Stafford ranked ahead of Aaron Rodgers, and I got Stafford there.
Okay, beautiful. So going back to Waller for a second, Waller to me is like the best case scenario for, and this marries up with the upcoming draft, of course. You know, if the absolute ceiling of Kyle Pitts, I think, basically is like Darren Waller is already there, and like, He's still in the prime of his career. I think people are kind of underrating that. He's just 28, coming off another great season. I mean, I just think that the sky continues to be the limit for Waller. I think he's got at least a couple more years of truly like elite play coming. So, I mean, he's ridiculous size, speed combo.
That's the thing. The people who dislike or who doubt him and doubted him last year, they're like, oh, well, he's a sixth round pick, a seventh round pick or whatever. He's an undrafted guy. His pedigree is bad. Guys drafted in these rounds and then they're cut. They never do well.
They just don't. Like, they're not thinking.
Yeah, it's like, well, dude, what round do you think he would go in if he was in the draft today? Mm-hmm. At least answer that question before you decide he is from this round, because he isn't. He wouldn't go in that round if he was in the draft today. And, you know, it's like guys who run 4.4s at 245 who catch 190 passes in 2 years probably should have gone a little higher, shouldn't they?
Yeah. So, the goldfish brain, it, it ends up benefiting you once again, the people around you with him. Going to Stafford, so like you said, you got him ranked ahead of Rodgers for this year, so that seems to imply that you are very bullish on the Stafford-Rams marriage and that McVay offense. So would you care to expound upon that a little bit?
Yeah, he's a little bit of – well, he's a significant durability worry. I definitely can't run away from that. But if he does play 16 games, I have basically no even slight fears about Stafford being worth this pick. I think Stafford, if he plays 16 games, has a really good shot at being a top eight quarterback. He can't catch up with the running quarterbacks, of course. But where that tier where like Drew Brees had been a couple of years ago, where it's like cute quarterback 7 or 8 or whatever, and you know you're getting no rushing production, but you're getting whatever 4,800 yards and 35, 40 touchdowns. I absolutely think Stafford can do that. I mean, we're only 2 years removed from Goff having like 4,600 yards and 35 touchdowns or whatever. So Stafford can absolutely do 5,000 and 40 touchdowns in that offense. Anyone who thinks otherwise is just not informed on either of the players or either of the systems of the Lions and the Rams. And but yeah, with that said, the durability is a concern. He's been playing hurt for years now. He's got, I think at 2 points now, he's had transverse process fractures. So yep. You'd like to see him take fewer hits, but I'm hoping McVay can be helpful on that too, because I mean, Stafford had Calvin Johnson earlier in his career. That's true. But still with the Lions, the broader system was not as favorable as it will be with the Rams.
That's a good point. And to your point on the McVay system maybe protecting Stafford as far as the hits are concerned, Jared Goff just a 4% sack percentage last year. That was among the best in the league among passers with at least 400 attempts. So that goes to show you that, you know, this is an offense that definitely it has the health interest of the quarterback definitely in mind there. So hopefully, yeah, Stafford stays upright and is able to really take advantage of that system. Looking beyond that, I really liked how you started to build your draft from there. So next up, you got Trevor Lawrence. We talked about him last week. This obviously won't be the last time that we talk about him, of course. He's going to be a favorite in drafts for us throughout the course of this season and beyond. I mean, he's just ridiculous. Getting him in the third, what a steal. I mean, you get him, yeah, after Joe Burrow, that's really nice.
Yeah, you can't,
opinion.
Guys, do not take Joe Burrow ahead of Trevor Lawrence. I know, like, people think they're being responsible and cautious by saying things like, well, Trevor Lawrence is a rookie. We don't know for sure whether he's going to be in it. Just understand that this is not a typical quarterback. Like, this is not whatever scenario you're comparing him to, it doesn't apply. This is different this time. He's not like other quarterbacks, and he's way better than Burrow, and we know he's, well, Burrow, we do not know, is playing in week one, you know? With Lawrence, at least he would have to get hurt for that to be the case. We do not have a single thing that is truly given with Burrow.
No, we really don't. That injury looked pretty awful. So, I mean, either way, even straight up, if you said that both of these guys are playing 16 games this year, even though Trevor Lawrence is playing for the woebegone Jacksonville Jaguars, I still am going Lawrence 10 times out of 10, just so much more physically gifted.
Lawrence was my next quarterback on my board after Stafford, so I have him ahead of Tannehill, definitely ahead of Hurts, and ahead of Brady too.
There we go. So now you got exposure to got the quarterbacks for both the Rams and the Jags. Next up, this is where that receiver deflation that you were alluding to earlier starts to come into play, where you can go ahead and get a guy like AJ Brown in the fourth round.
Yeah, I thought a long time about going running back at this pick, but I decided to go with A.J. Brown because Calvin Ridley had just gone off the board. I have A.J. Brown ranked ahead of him. DK Metcalf had gone 4 or 5 picks ahead. I think I have Brown ranked about the same. I haven't actually thought it through specifically. I haven't done projections, but I know I think A.J. Brown is the best receiver in the league. And in best ball and 2-wide receiver, I think he actually is a little bit more viable than in 3-wide receiver, because we know that the Titans are not going to do the air raid. That's obviously not possible. And when they have their choice, they make it pretty much the Derrick Henry show, which can only come at A.J. Brown's expense, really. But when they do let A.J. Brown go free, he puts up huge numbers, like almost invariably when they give him the usage, it just happens. And those games will happen. So he'll have his ceiling weeks, these weeks where when he is on, he ranks in the top three and just, you know, it's non-negotiable. If he gets 10 targets, he's in the top three that week. And then when he has his dud weeks, the fact that it's two receivers instead of three means that it should, in theory at least, be easier to not get burned those weeks. It should be easier to have a better option those weeks. Whereas the weeks that A.J. Brown is on, you really can't find anyone in the entire league who's definitely better. It's like, I would say Devonta Adams is the only one who I guess Tyreek is pretty close to. But I think A.J. Brown can basically give me the number of like top three wide receiver scores that I need. While the inconsistency should prove immaterial. But yeah, I took him, the next two receivers to go before my next pick were Michael Thomas and Keenan Allen, who I'd be fine with having them or whatever, but I definitely prefer A.J. Brown's just, you know, shrieking upside in a best ball format.
Definitely, yeah. Preaching to the choir when it comes to A.J. Brown, of course, just an absolute stud. Then, you know, again, with this format, these positions, it's a lot different, the way that you construct your roster, a lot different than what you would in a normal one quarterback league and in a non tight end premium. So this is where you've got your first running back, and I think this was an awesome value. You went with James Robinson, of course, the second year player in Jacksonville, had such a good rookie year, now is in an offense that theoretically should be like so much more healthy and should be, you know, I'm borrowing from your analysis last week, but this is an offense that's going to be scoring a lot more touchdowns this time around, and you know, with that you figure that Robinson's touchdown count probably going to come up as well.
Yeah, hopefully. And I forgot to mention, the part of the reason why I took AJ Brown rather than a running back at the last pick was because guys like Antonio Gibson, Josh Jacobs, J.K. Dobbins, Miles Sanders, Joe Mixon, and Robinson, and Clyde Edwards-Helaire, I considered him too, they were all on the board, and I thought, you know, I don't see enough difference between these six guys. I do see a quick difference between a difference between A.J. Brown and Michael Thomas and Keenan Allen, but if not those two, then there's a huge gap, in my opinion, between A.J. Brown and someone like, maybe not huge between Allen Robinson. If he goes to a dream team for him, he could obviously be like the wide receiver one. But Julio Jones is like the fourth receiver taken after AJ Brown. And I know I said I loved him last week, but I'm like more convinced that they're going to go away from Matt Ryan at some point this year, which is a little concerning. Basically, I was like, I don't really care which of these six running backs I get, but I do start to care about the receivers after three or four. So I went with that, and I was totally happy to get James Robinson. I was probably thinking Mixon, if I'm being totally honest. It's hard to know for sure because I didn't have the option. He went the pick earlier. But when I got to the second round, when I got to that fifth round and I saw James Robinson was still there, I went with him over Clyde Edwards-Helaire because obviously Clyde Edwards-Helaire is a good player. I think he, if anything, is kind of underrated on a personal level. Like as an individual player, he's underrated. Like you'd think he
wasn't the number three overall player this year. He must suck.
Right. Because some people were dumb enough to say that he should go in the top three in redraft. Now he's bad for only being like the running back 17 or whatever. And in 12 games, moreover, you know, it felt like he had 500 yards last year and he actually had like 1,000 in 13 or 12 games or whatever it was. So he'll be fine. But Damian Williams is faster than him and 15 pounds heavier than him. And we already know he can produce in that offense. So whereas James Robinson might face competition that he didn't face last year, it is definitely the case that Clyde Edwards-Helaire will face competition that he didn't last year, and Damian Williams might point blank be better in that offense than Clyde Edwards-Helaire is. And I think I say that as an Edwards-Helaire advocate. Like, I think he's a good player. I thought he was a justifiable pick in the first round last year. But Damian Williams is a system player who perfectly fits their system, and it's not easy to find people who do what James Robinson did last year. I know people think like, oh, they just were tanking. It's like they weren't tanking. They could have tanked by not cutting Leonard Fournette and letting him walk as a free agent, thus getting a compensatory draft pick for him leaving. They wanted James Robinson on the field, and he did really good the entire year. And if anything, at this point, the Jaguars have an incentive to run him into the ground on a super cheap contract so that if he turns out to be a dud, he can walk in free agency too in a couple of years. But in the meantime, it's like they got a guy on what, like the 55th highest contract at running back, and they can get 800 snaps out of him. That's a no-brainer. They're going to spend that. If if they have any shot of being a good team with all this this resources that they've been given, they will not spend money, and they will not spend any sooner than maybe a third round pick at running back. And if they do, that player is not likely to be particularly close to James Robinson.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, his talent, I mean, it's crazy that he went undrafted. I think that, again, all the craziness of last offseason when the pandemic was really hitting, it really squeezed out those FCS players and led to, I think, like a record low FCS representation in the draft. And, you know, we saw some contributors come from those ranks, and of course Robinson chief among them. Coming up next, so you got Sam Darnold as your depth quarterback, and then some of your stacking best ball theory came into practice here, where you got some of the weapons for both Matthew Stafford and Trevor Lawrence in going after Robert Woods and both DJ Chark. Is that something that you were absolutely trying to do?
Yeah, I was trying to get Woods and Chark. I was considering going Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp, but Cooper Kupp got taken the pick before me, and I was totally happy to take DJ Chark. I was going to be anxious about that decision because it's an easy one to get wrong, it feels like. I think DJ Chark is very clearly one of the best receivers in the league, and I think people have lost perspective on how good he is, and they're not considering the upside he would have if he went from one of the worst offenses in the league to an average or better one. He doesn't need to be in a specifically good offense, although I think Jacksonville will be closer to good than bad, but he could break out hugely with just an average or something close to average offense. Like, we know that already because he did that in 2019. And that offense wasn't great or anything. It still had Gardner Minshew at quarterback. Trevor Lawrence is going to change so much about that offense in ways that can't really be quantified. And people who don't understand, like, the more kind of like technical physics of football won't be able to anticipate this, but it's going to be a total paradigm change. Like, it's going to absolutely change everything having Lawrence there. And DJ Chark, I think, could have, like, he's had some injury concerns, so that's something that I have some issue with him, but he could have something like a 1,400-yard season. And if not that, then at the very least I can also say people who are ranking LaVisca Chenault ahead of Chark are wrong. Like, you shouldn't do that. And it's like, I like LaVisca Chenault, but he objectively cannot do as much as Chark. Chark is the wide receiver one on that team. There's no question about it.
Right. And Chenault is great at what he does, but he's not that vertical field stretcher the way that Chark is, of course,
right,
that plays on the outside. And
Chark plays at all levels of the field, and Chenault can only play two.
Yep. So, I mean, while Chenault is, you know, that guy that kind of has that running back playing receiver,
he's like a big slot tight end kind of thing. Yeah, he's good at
it's useful.
Just like one of those things, like, if you're not getting, you know, these 40-yard, someone's getting 40-yard bombs in this Trevor Lawrence offense.
Yes.
And it's not Chenault.
No, that will be Chark. Maybe Chenault can be the Amari Rodgers if you wanted to.
Maybe they signed Curtis Samuel and he's in on it, but it's not Chenault.
Ooh, Curtis Samuel, that Urban Meyer connection.
They got a lot of money and not much to obviously spend it on, so I think Curtis to Jacksonville makes a lot of sense.
What would that do for you as far as your Curtis evaluation and kind of exposure?
It would be like a little tiny bit of a concern for Chark, but it would not be a meaningful one. It would be like, whereas right now, I think Chark could be a league winner type who gives you like 1,400, 1,500 yards. If Curtis is there, his cap is probably 1,400 and his realistic range is like 1,200, maybe 1,300, which is still fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, Curtis Samuel is really good. And I think he's actually somewhat miscast as a slot receiver last year. The results were really good because Joe Brady designed a good Carolina offense that got good results from all of Curtis and Anderson and Moore. But those guys were playing in the wrong positions. And because Chenault is slower, kind of does H-back stuff, I think he would take a lot of those slot reps from Samuel that would have been, you know, where he ran in Carolina. But it would be good, I think, to get Curtis Samuel outside more because he was getting open all the time in 2019 on the outside running deep routes. But Kyle Allen just missed because he sucks. And then this next year, they were like, we got to get the ball in Curtis's hands. And it's like, that's fine, but don't put one of the best outside downfield route runners, who incidentally is one of the fastest receivers in the league, don't put him in the same position as Danny Amendola.
Right. Yeah, that just feels like a bit of a no-brainer in that sense. And then rounding it out, You went after Chase Edmonds next. Odell Beckham is a nice value in round 10. Austin Hooper as your backup. Tight end Tony Pollard. And then Cam Newton, Harrison Butker, Anthony McFarland. So walk us through a little bit of your just kind of end game strategy or mid round to end game strategy there.
Yeah, I was kind of doing like not exactly zero RB, but pretty light running back because some of these prices just look wrong to me, especially when so many of these high prices are guys that we do not know where they're going to play in 2021. Like, I'm not taking Chris Carson in the seventh. I'm not taking, like, Javonte Williams went in the sixth round. I'm not taking Javonte Williams eight picks after James Robinson. You know, this is getting out of hand. Some of these prices, you see people like trying to chase running back value, but they don't know how to identify it. And they're coming up with these weird, you know, pricing decisions. So I just kind of decided, like, I'm going to let them chase those. And in the case of Edmonds, I knew I was kind of reaching a little bit, and I really didn't want to pick him over Odell Beckham. Like, I wanted to take Odell Beckham in the ninth round. I almost took Beckham in the eighth over Chark. And so, like, I got to the ninth and I was like, oh man, I gotta take Odell right now. But then, you know, Kenny Gainwell, who I like a lot more in the ninth than I do Javonte Williams in the early sixth. But I still don't like Kenny Gainwell in the ninth either if I can take Chase Edmonds, because I know where Chase Edmonds is going to play, or at least I'm pretty sure. And there's a chance that they don't re-sign Kenyon Drake, in which case whoever they might add in free agency or the draft is likely to take less of a share than Kenyon Drake. So went with Edmonds, and basically my formula running back from this point is acknowledging that I am a long shot at the position and that I need to just kind of get some I need to short the stock of some of the big running backs who are otherwise around the league. And so maybe I should have took Alex Mattison instead of Harrison Butker, but at kicker, you got to get kicker in this league. And in kicker too, it's like, we don't know who half of these guys are playing for next year. We don't know if they're playing for anyone next year. So I kind of reached for Butker, cause I was like, I don't want to get stuck trying to guess who's going to kick for the stupid, you know, Texans this year or something like that.
Sure.
And just get a zero at kicker all year, cause I guessed wrong. Mm-hmm. Trying to be cheap. But I'm getting like, I got Tony Pollard to short Zeke Elliott. I maybe should have took Alex Mattison to short Dalvin Cook instead of taking Harrison Butker, but oh well. I took Anthony McFarland, not so much to short anyone. That one was more like there's an off chance that he actually kind of starts this year for Pittsburgh, for Matt Canada taking over there. But I'm looking at
that Maryland
running
connection.
Yeah, totally. And I'm looking at probably looking at Damian Williams if he makes it to me in the next round. I almost took Damian instead of McFarland, but yeah, it's like at running back, I'm obviously at the point where I need to get somebody who, in the event of an injury on their team ahead of them, they give me the upside that I otherwise haven't paid for at running back.
Okay, I see. So good stuff there. Yeah, as far as playing out that running back strategy, who is the GameStop stock of running backs for right now? Who's getting pumped that shouldn't be?
Let's see, which running back do I hope gets so valuable it crashes this illegitimate hell economy that I hate so much? I don't see anyone who can pull it off, but if I'm looking at just like the numbers that I don't like at running back, I understand what some of these people are thinking, but like Austin Eckler is too cheap. That's the thing that I looking at this, like, he should not go in the third round. He should not go a pick within Cam Akers. Akers is fine. That Rams offense is going to be really good, but Eckler can do Marshall Faulk stuff this year. He already did it 2 years ago. He kind of did it when he was playing last year. So he's going too low. And then the ones that are going too high, I guess, I think are Najee Harris and Javonte Williams, because people don't know how to scout rookies. They don't know how to do anything other than look at pre-draft media, look at, you know, click to send on what round they're projected for, and then plug in that round to some formula where it's like, oh, they're 5'10", 220, and they're projecting in the first round. That means they're the same as Nick Chubb, and that means Javonte Williams is Nick Chubb. It's like, Javonte Williams to me looks like ACC Samaje Perine. And that I still like Samaje Perine / I think he could have been better if he weighed 225 instead of 240. But the point is, that guy doesn't run away from people. And when he breaks tackles, he does it very sluggishly. And it's kind of almost a David Montgomery thing, where some of the tackles that he breaks are tackles that get brought upon him because he's not running away fast enough. So I think he's like, people don't know how to scout running backs. And I think he's clearly a case of it. And then Harris, too. like, I think he's a decent player. I'm much more sold on Harris than I am Williams. And I like Williams enough if people are being reasonable, but they're supposing he's going to be like a first round pick. And it's like, you guys got to stop listening to people on the internet. You got to like, you got to learn how to actually read this for yourself.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I see tweets every morning that's like, I'm brave enough to rank Javonte Williams as my RB1. It's like, all right, man. Well, gonna go ahead and hit that mute.
Yeah, Travis Etienne could have run for like 500 yards against that Miami defense if Clemson wanted him to. Like, look at the schedule. Like, I actually am close to ranking Michael Carter ahead of Javonte Williams because he at least had multiple years of big production. That ACC schedule for North Carolina this year was utter trash. Like, you cannot be taking him in the sixth round, and you can't be taking him at like two full rounds ahead of AJ Dillon, two whole rounds ahead of Ronald Jones. It's like, it's too much.
Yep, I completely agree. And yeah, that UNC schedule of defenses that they were going against, very, very soft. That's gonna wrap it up for this edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast. For Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.